consists of whatever a body is obliged to do, and that play consists of whatever a body is not obliged to do. He goes on to write, "There are wealthy gentlemen in England who drive four-horse passenger coaches 20 or 30 miles on a daily line in the summer because the privilege costs them considerable money. But if they were offered wages for the service, that would turn it into work, and then they would resign." In other words, rewards can perform a weird sort of behavioral alchemy. They can transform an interesting task into a drudge. They can turn play into work. And by diminishing intrinsic motivation, they can send performance, creativity, and even upstanding behavior toppling like dominoes. Let's call this the Sawyer effect. A sampling of intriguing experiments around the world reveals the four realms where this effect kicks in and shows yet again the mismatch between what science knows and what business does. Intrinsic motivation. Behavioral scientists like Deasy began discovering the Sawyer effect nearly 40 years ago, although they didn't use that term. Instead, they referred to the counterintuitive consequences of extrinsic incentives as the hidden costs of rewards. That, in fact, was the title of the first book on the subject, a 1978 research volume that was edited by psychologists Mark Lepper and David Green. One of Lepper and Green's early studies, which they carried out with a third colleague, Robert Nisbet, has become a classic in the field and among the most cited articles in the motivation literature. The three researchers watched a classroom of preschoolers for several days and identified the children who chose to spend their free play time drawing. Then they fashioned an experiment to test the effect of rewarding an activity these children clearly enjoyed. The researchers divided the children into three groups. The first was the expected award group. They showed each of these children a good player certificate, adorned with a blue ribbon and featuring the child's name, and asked if the child wanted to draw in order to receive the award. The second group was the unexpected award group. Researchers asked these children simply if they wanted to draw. If they decided to, when the session ended, the researchers handed each child one of the good player certificates. The third group was the no award group. Researchers asked these children if they wanted to draw, but neither promised them a certificate at the beginning nor gave them one at the end. 2 weeks later, back in the classroom, teachers set out paper and markers during the preschool's free play period while the researchers secretly observed the students. Children previously in the unexpected award and no award groups drew just as much and with the same relish as they had before the experiment. But children in the first group, the ones who'd expected and then received an award, showed much less interest and spent much less time drawing. The Sawyer effect had taken hold. Even 2 weeks later, those alluring prizes, so common in classrooms and cubicles, had turned play into work. To be clear, it wasn't necessarily the rewards themselves that dampened the children's interest. Remember, when children didn't expect a reward, receiving one had little impact on their intrinsic motivation. Only contingent rewards, if you do this, then you'll get that, had the negative effect. Why? If then rewards require people to forfeit some of their autonomy, like the gentleman driving carriages for money instead of fun, they're no longer fully controlling their lives, and that can spring a hole in the bottom of their motivational bucket, draining an activity of its enjoyment. Lepper and Green replicated these results in several subsequent experiments with children. As time went on, other researchers found similar results with adults. Over and over again, they discovered that extrinsic rewards, in particular contingent, expected, if-then rewards, snuffed out the third drive. These insights proved so controversial. After all, they called into question a standard practice of most companies and schools, that in 1999, DC and two colleagues reanalyzed nearly three decades of studies on the subject to confirm the findings. Careful consideration of reward effects reported in 128 experiments lead to the conclusion that tangible rewards tend to have a substantially negative effect on intrinsic motivation, they determined. When institutions, families, schools, businesses, and athletic teams, for example, focus on the short term and opt for controlling people's behavior, they do considerable long-term damage. Try to encourage a kid to learn math by paying her for each workbook page she completes, and she'll almost certainly become more diligent in the short term and lose interest in math in the long term. Take an industrial designer who loves his work and try to get him to do better by making his pay contingent on a hit product, and he'll almost certainly work like a maniac in the short term, but become less interested in his job in the long term. As one leading behavioral science textbook puts it, people use rewards expecting to gain the benefit of increasing another person's motivation and behavior, but in so doing, they often incur the unintentional and hidden cost of undermining that person's intrinsic motivation toward the activity. This is one of the most robust findings in social science, and also one of the most ignored. Despite the work of a few skilled and passionate popularizers, in particular Alfie Kohn, whose prescient 1993 book, Punished by Rewards, lays out a devastating indictment of extrinsic incentives, we persist in trying to motivate people this way. Perhaps we're scared to let go of Motivation 2.0 despite its obvious downsides. Perhaps we can't get our minds around the peculiar quantum mechanics of intrinsic motivation. Or perhaps there's a better reason. Even if those controlling if-then rewards activate the Sawyer effect and suffocate the third drive, maybe they actually get people to perform better. If that's the case, perhaps they're not so bad. So let's ask, do extrinsic rewards boost performance? Four economists went to India to find out. High performance. One of the difficulties of laboratory experiments that test the impact of extrinsic motivators like cash is the cost. If you're going to pay people to perform, you have to pay them a meaningful amount. And in the United States or Europe, where standards of living are high, an individually meaningful amount multiplied by dozens of participants can rack up unsustainably large bills for behavioral scientists. In part to circumvent this problem, a quartet of economists, including Dan Ariely, whom I mentioned in the last chapter, set up shop in Madurai, India, to gauge the effects of extrinsic incentives on performance. Because the cost of living in rural India is much lower than in North America, the researchers could offer large rewards without breaking their own banks. They recruited 87 participants and asked them to play several games. For example, tossing tennis balls at a target, unscrambling anagrams, recalling a string of digits that required motor skills, creativity, or concentration. To test the power of incentives, the experimenters offered three types of rewards for reaching certain performance levels. One-third of the participants could earn a small reward, 4 rupees, at the time worth around 50 U.S. cents and equal to about a day's pay in Madurai, for reaching their performance targets. One-third could earn a medium reward, 40 rupees, about $5 or 2 weeks' pay. And one-third could earn a very large reward, 400 rupees, about $50 or nearly 5 months' pay. What happened? Did the size of the reward predict the quality of the performance? Yes, but not in the way you might expect. As it turned out, the people offered the medium-sized bonus didn't perform any better than those offered the small one. And those in the 400 rupee super incentivized group? They fared worst of all. By nearly every measure, they lagged behind both the low reward and medium reward participants. Reporting the results for the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, the researchers wrote, "In 8 of the 9 tasks we examined across 3 experiments, higher incentives led to worse performance." Let's circle back to this conclusion for a moment. 4 economists, 2 from MIT, 1 from Carnegie Mellon, and 1 from the University of Chicago, undertake research for the Federal Reserve System, one of the most powerful economic actors in the world. But instead of affirming a simple business principle, higher rewards lead to higher performance, they seem to refute it. And it's not just American researchers reaching these counterintuitive conclusions? In 2009, scholars at the London School of Economics, alma mater of 11 Nobel laureates in economics, analyzed 51 studies of corporate pay-for-performance plans. These economists' conclusion? We find that financial incentives can result in a negative impact on overall performance. On both sides of the Atlantic, the gap between what science is learning and what business is doing is wide. Many existing institutions provide very large incentives for exactly the type of tasks we used here, Arielli and his colleagues wrote. Our results challenge that assumption. Our experiment suggests that one cannot assume that introducing or raising incentives always improves performance. Indeed, in many instances, contingent incentives, that cornerstone of how businesses attempt to motivate employees, may be a losing proposition. Of course, procrastinating writers notwithstanding, few of us spend our working hours flinging tennis balls or doing anagrams. How about the more creative tasks that are more akin to what we actually do on the job? Creativity. For a quick test of problem-solving prowess, few exercises are more useful than the candle problem. Devised by psychologist Carl Duncker in the 1930s, the candle problem is used in a wide variety of experiments in behavioral science. Follow along and see how you do. You sit at a table next to a wooden wall, and the experimenter gives you the following materials: a candle, a box of thumbtacks, and a book of matches. Your job is to attach the candle to the wall so that the wax doesn't drip on the table. Think for a moment about how you'd solve the problem. Many people begin by trying to tack the candle to the wall, but that doesn't work. Some light a match, melt the side of the candle, and try to adhere it to the wall. That doesn't work either. But after 5 or 10 minutes, most people stumble onto the solution, which is to take the tacks out of the box, tack the box to the wall, put the candle in the box, and then light the candle. The key is to overcome what's called functional fixedness. You look at the box and see only one function, as a container for the tacks. But by thinking afresh, you actually see that the box can have another function, as a platform for the candle. To reprise the language from the previous chapter, the solution isn't algorithmic, following a set path, but heuristic, breaking from the path to discover a novel strategy. What happens when you give people a conceptual challenge like this and offer them rewards for speedy solutions? Sam Glucksberg, a psychologist now at Princeton University, tested this a few decades ago by timing how quickly two groups of participants solved the candle problem. He told the first group that he was timing their work merely to establish norms for how long it typically took someone to complete this sort of puzzle. To the second group, he offered incentives. If a participant's time was among the fastest 25% of all the people being tested, the participant would receive $5. If the participant's time was the fastest of all, the reward would be $20. Adjusted for inflation, those are decent sums of money for a few minutes of effort. A nice motivator. How much faster did the incentivized group come up with the solution? On average, it took them nearly 3.5 minutes longer. Yes, 3.5 minutes longer. Whenever I've relayed these results to a group of business people, the reaction is almost always a loud, pained, involuntary gasp. In direct contravention to the core tenets of Motivation 2.0, an incentive designed to clarify thinking and sharpen creativity ended up clouding thinking and dulling creativity. Why? Rewards, by their very nature, narrow our focus. That's helpful when there's a clear path to a solution. They help us stare ahead and race faster. But if-then motivators are terrible for challenges like the candle problem. As this experiment shows, the rewards narrowed people's focus and blinkered the wide view that might have allowed them to see new uses for old objects. Something similar seems to occur for challenges that aren't so much about cracking an existing problem, but about iterating something new. Teresa Amabile, the Harvard Business School professor and one of the world's leading researchers on creativity, has frequently tested the effects of contingent rewards on the creative process. In one study, she and two colleagues recruited 23 professional artists from the United States who had produced both commissioned and non-commissioned artwork. They asked the artists to randomly select 10 commission works and 10 non-commission works. Then Amabile and her team gave the works to a panel of accomplished artists and curators who knew nothing about the study and asked the experts to rate the pieces on creativity and technical skill. "Our results were quite startling," the researchers wrote. "The commissioned works were rated as significantly less creative than the non-commissioned works, yet they were not rated as different in technical quality. Moreover, the artists reported feeling significantly more constrained when doing commissioned works than when doing non-commissioned works." One artist whom they interviewed describes the Sawyer effect in action. "Not always, but a lot of the time, when you are doing a piece for someone else, it becomes more work than joy. When I work for myself, there is the pure joy of creating, and I can work through the night and not even know it. On a commissioned piece, you have to check yourself. Be careful to do what the client wants." Another study of artists over a longer period shows that a concern for outside rewards might actually hinder eventual success. In the early 1960s, researchers surveyed sophomores and juniors at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago about their attitudes toward work and whether they were more intrinsically or extrinsically motivated. Using these data as a benchmark, another researcher followed up with these students in the early 1980s to see how their careers were progressing. Among the starkest findings, especially for men, the less evidence of extrinsic motivation during art school, the more success in professional art, both several years after graduation and nearly 20 years later. Painters and sculptors who were intrinsically motivated, those for whom the joy of discovery and the challenge of creation were their own rewards, were able to weather the tough times and the lack of remuneration and recognition that inevitably accompany artistic careers. And that led to yet another paradox in the Alice in Wonderland world of the third drive. Those artists who pursued their painting and sculpture more for the pleasure of the activity itself than for extrinsic rewards have produced art that has been socially recognized as superior, the study said. It is those who are least motivated to pursue extrinsic rewards who eventually receive them. This result is not true across all tasks, of course. Amabile and others have found that extrinsic rewards can be effective for algorithmic tasks, those that depend on following an existing formula to its logical conclusion. But for more right-brain undertakings, those that demand flexible problem-solving, inventiveness, or conceptual understanding, contingent rewards can be dangerous. Rewarded subjects often have a harder time seeing the periphery and crafting original solutions. This, too, is one of the sturdiest findings in social science, especially as Amabile and others have refined it over the years. For artists, scientists, inventors, school children, and the rest of us, intrinsic motivation, the drive to do something because it is interesting, challenging, and absorbing, is essential for high levels of creativity. But the if-then motivators that are the staple of most businesses often stifle rather than stir creative thinking. As the economy moves toward more right-brain conceptual work, as more of us deal with our own versions of the candle problem, this might be the most alarming gap between what science knows and what business does. Good behavior. Philosophers and medical professionals have long debated whether blood donors should be paid. Some claim that blood, like human tissues or organs, is special, that we shouldn't be able to buy and sell it like a barrel of crude oil or a crate of ball bearings. Others argue that we should shelve our squeamishness because paying for this substance will ensure an ample supply. But in 1970, British sociologist Richard Titmuss, who had studied blood donation in the United Kingdom, offered a bolder speculation. Paying for blood wasn't just immoral, he said. It was also inefficient. If Britain decided to pay citizens to donate, that would actually reduce the country's blood supply. It was an oddball notion, to be sure. Economists snickered, and Titmuss never tested the idea. It was merely a philosophical hunch. But a quarter of a century later, two Swedish economists decided to see if Titmuss was right. In an intriguing field experiment, they visited a regional blood center in Gothenburg and found 153 women who were interested in giving blood. Then, as seems to be the custom among motivation researchers, they divided the women into three groups. Experimenters told those in the first group that blood donation was voluntary. These participants could give blood, but they wouldn't receive a payment. The experimenters offered the second group a different arrangement. If these participants gave blood, they'd each receive 50 Swedish kroner, about $7. The third group received a variation on that second offer, a 50 kroner payment with an immediate option to donate the amount to a children's cancer charity. Of the first group, 52% of the women decided to go ahead and donate blood. They were altruistic citizens, apparently, willing to do a good deed for their fellow Swedes, even in the absence of compensation. And the second group? Motivation 2.0 would suggest that this group might be a bit more motivated to donate. They'd shown up, which indicated intrinsic motivation. Getting a few kroner on top might give that impulse a boost. But, as you might have guessed by now, that's not what happened. In this group, only 30% of the women decided to give blood. Instead of increasing the number of blood donors, offering to pay people decreased the number by nearly half. Meanwhile, the third group, which had the option of donating the fee directly to charity, responded much the same as the first group. 53% became blood donors. Titmuss's hunch might have been right after all. Adding a monetary incentive didn't lead to more of the desired behavior. It led to less. The reason? It tainted an altruistic act and crowded out the intrinsic desire to do something good. Doing good is what blood donation is all about. It provides what the American Red Cross brochures say is a feeling that money can't buy. That's why voluntary blood donations invariably increase during natural disasters and other calamities. But if governments were to pay people to help their neighbors during these crises, donations might decline. That said, in the Swedish example, the reward itself wasn't inherently destructive. The immediate option to donate the 50 kroner payment rather than pocket it seemed to negate the effect. This too is extremely important. It's not that all rewards at all times are bad. For instance, when the Italian government gave blood donors paid time off work, donations increased. The law removed an obstacle to altruism. So while a few advocates would have you believe in the basic evil of extrinsic incentives, that's just not empirically true. What is true is that mixing rewards with inherently interesting, creative, or noble tasks, deploying them without understanding the peculiar science of motivation, is a very dangerous game. When used in these situations, if-then rewards usually do more harm than good. By neglecting the ingredients of genuine motivation, autonomy, mastery, and purpose, they limit what each of us can achieve. More of what we don't want. In the upside-down universe of the third drive, rewards can often produce less of the very things they're trying to encourage. But that's not the end of the story. When used improperly, extrinsic motivators can have another unintended collateral consequence. They can give us more of what we don't want. Here again, what business does hasn't caught up with what science knows. And what science is revealing is that carrots and sticks can promote bad behavior, create addiction, and encourage short-term thinking at the expense of the long view. Unethical behavior. What could be more valuable than having a goal? From our earliest days, teachers, coaches, and parents advise us to set goals and to work mightily to achieve them. And with good reason. Goals work. The academic literature shows that by helping us tune out distractions, goals can get us to try harder, work longer, and achieve more. But recently, a group of scholars from the Harvard Business School, Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, the University of Arizona's Eller College of Management, and the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School questioned the efficacy of this broad prescription. Rather than being offered as an over-the-counter salve for boosting performance, goal setting should be prescribed selectively, presented with a warning label, and closely monitored, they wrote. Goals that people set for themselves and that are devoted to attaining mastery are usually healthy. But goals imposed by others, sales targets, quarterly returns, standardized test scores, and so on, can sometimes have dangerous side effects. Like all extrinsic motivators, goals narrow our focus. That's one reason they can be effective. They concentrate the mind. But as we've seen, a narrowed focus exacts a cost. For complex or conceptual tasks, offering a reward can blinker the wide-ranging thinking necessary to come up with an innovative solution. Likewise, when an extrinsic goal is paramount, especially a short-term, measurable one whose achievement delivers a big payoff, its presence can restrict our view of the broader dimensions of our behavior. As the cadre of business school professors write, substantial evidence demonstrates that in addition to motivating constructive effort, goal setting can induce unethical behavior. The examples are legion, the researchers note. Sears imposes a sales quota on its auto repair staff, and workers respond by overcharging customers and completing unnecessary repairs. Enron sets lofty revenue goals, and the race to meet them by any means possible catalyzes the company's collapse. Ford is so intent on producing a certain car at a certain weight at a certain price by a certain date that it omits safety checks and unleashes the dangerous Ford Pinto. The problem with making an extrinsic reward the only destination that matters is that some people will choose the quickest route there, even if it means taking the low road. Indeed, most of the scandals and misbehavior that have seemed endemic to modern life involve shortcuts. Executives game their quarterly earnings so they can snag a performance bonus. Secondary school counselors doctor student transcripts so their seniors can get into college. Athletes inject themselves with steroids to post better numbers and trigger lucrative performance bonuses. Contrast that approach with behavior sparked by intrinsic motivation. When the reward is the activity itself, deepening learning, delighting customers, doing one's best, there are no shortcuts. The only route to the destination is the high road. In some sense, it's impossible to act unethically because the person who's disadvantaged isn't a competitor, but yourself. Of course, all goals are not created equal, and let me emphasize this point. Goals and extrinsic rewards aren't inherently corrupting. But goals are more toxic than Motivation 2.0 recognizes. In fact, the business school professors suggest that they should come with their own warning label that reads, "Goals may cause systematic problems for organizations due to narrowed focus, unethical behavior, increased risk-taking, decreased cooperation, and decreased intrinsic motivation. Use care when applying goals in your organization." If carrots as goals sometimes encourage unworthy behavior, then sticks as punishment should be able to halt it, right? Not so fast. The third drive is less mechanistic and more surprising than that, as two Israeli economists discovered at some daycare centers. In 2000, economists Yuri Ganizi and Aldo Rusticini studied a group of childcare facilities in Haifa, Israel, for 20 weeks. The centers opened at 7:30 a.m. and closed at 4 p.m. Parents had to retrieve their children by the closing time, or a teacher would have to stay late. During the first 4 weeks of the experiment, the economists recorded how many parents arrived late each week. Then, before the fifth week, with the permission of the daycare centers, they posted the following sign. Announcement: fine for coming late. As you all know, the official closing time of the daycare center is 4 p.m. every day. Since some parents have been coming late, we, with the approval of the Authority for Private Daycare Centers in Israel, have decided to impose a fine on parents who come late to pick up their children. As of next Sunday, a fine of 10 Israeli shekels will be charged each time a child is collected after 4:10 p.m. This fine will be calculated monthly. It is to be paid together with the regular monthly payment. Sincerely, the manager of the daycare center. The theory underlying the fine, said Ghanizi and Rusticini, was straightforward. When negative consequences are imposed on a behavior, they will produce a reduction of that particular response. In other words, thwack the parents with a fine, and they'll stop showing up late. But that's not what happened. After the introduction of the fine, we observed a steady increase in the number of parents coming late, the Economist wrote. The rate finally settled at a level that was higher and almost twice as large as the initial one. And in language reminiscent of Harry Harlow's head-scratching, they write that the existing literature didn't account for such a result. Indeed, the possibility of an increase in the behavior being punished was not even considered. Up pops another bug in Motivation 2.0. One reason that most parents showed up on time is because they had a relationship with the teachers, who, after all, were caring for their precious sons and daughters and wanted to treat them fairly. Parents had an intrinsic desire to be scrupulous about punctuality. But the threat of a fine, like the promise of the kroner in the blood experiment, edged aside that third drive. The fine shifted the parents' decision from a partly moral obligation, to be fair to my kids' teachers, to a pure transaction. I can buy extra time. There wasn't room for both. The punishment didn't promote good behavior. It crowded it out. Addiction. If some scientists believe that if-then motivators and other extrinsic rewards resemble prescription drugs that carry potentially dangerous side effects, others believe they're more like illegal drugs that foster a deeper and more pernicious dependency. According to these scholars, cash rewards and shiny trophies can provide a delicious jolt of pleasure at first, but the feeling soon dissipates. And to keep it alive, the recipient requires ever larger and more frequent doses. The Russian economist Anton Suvorov has constructed an elaborate econometric model to demonstrate this effect, configured around what's called principal-agent theory. Think of the principal as the motivator, the employer, the teacher, the parent. Think of the agent as the motivatee, the employee, the student, the child. A principal essentially tries to get the agent to do what the principal wants, while the agent balances his own interests with whatever the principal is offering. Using a blizzard of complicated equations that test a variety of scenarios between principal and agent, Suvorov has reached conclusions that make intuitive sense to any parent who's tried to get her kids to empty the garbage. By offering a reward, a principal signals to the agent that the task is undesirable. If the task were desirable, the agent wouldn't need a prod. But that initial signal, and the reward that goes with it, forces the principal onto a path that's difficult to leave. Offer too small a reward, and the agent won't comply. But offer a reward that's enticing enough to get the agent to act the first time, and the principal is doomed to give it again in the second. There's no going back. Pay your son to take out the trash, and you've pretty much guaranteed the kid will never do it again for free. Once more, once the initial money buzz tapers off, you'll likely have to increase the payment to continue compliance. As Suvorov explains, rewards are addictive in that once offered, a contingent reward makes an agent expect it whenever a similar task is faced, which in turn compels the principal to use rewards over and over again. And before long, the existing reward may no longer suffice. It will quickly feel less like a bonus and more like the status quo, which then forces the principal to offer larger rewards to achieve the same effect. This addictive pattern is not merely blackboard theory. Brian Knudsen, then a neuroscientist at the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, demonstrated as much in an experiment using the brain scanning technique known as functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. He placed healthy volunteers into a giant scanner to watch how their brains responded during a game that involved the prospect of either winning or losing money. When participants knew they had a chance to win cash, activation occurred in the part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens. That is, when the participants anticipated getting a reward, but not when they anticipated losing one, a burst of the brain chemical dopamine surged to this part of the brain. Knudsen, who is now at Stanford University, has found similar results in subsequent studies where people anticipated rewards. What makes this response interesting for our purposes is that the same basic physiological process, this particular brain chemical surging to this particular part of the brain, is what happens in addiction. The mechanism of most addictive drugs is to send a fusillade of dopamine to the nucleus accumbens. The feeling delights, then dissipates, then demands another dose. In other words, if we watch how people's brains respond, promising them monetary rewards and giving them cocaine, nicotine, or amphetamines look disturbingly similar. This could be one reason that paying people to stop smoking often works in the short run. It replaces one dangerous addiction with another more benign one. Rewards' addictive qualities can also distort decision-making. Knudsen has found that activation in the nucleus accumbens seems to predict both risky choices and risk-seeking mistakes. Get people fired up with the prospect of rewards, and instead of making better decisions, as Motivation 2.0 hopes, they can actually make worse ones. As Knudsen writes, this may explain why casinos surround their guests with reward cues, for example, inexpensive food, free liquor, surprise gifts, potential jackpot prizes. Anticipation of rewards activates the nucleus accumbens, which may lead to an increase in the likelihood of individuals switching from risk-averse to risk-seeking behavior. In short, while that dangled carrot isn't all bad in all circumstances, in some instances it operates similar to a rock of crack cocaine, and can induce behavior similar to that found around the crap table or roulette wheel. Not exactly what we hope to achieve when we motivate our teammates and coworkers. Short-term thinking. Think back to the candle problem again. The incentivized participants performed worse than their counterparts because they were so focused on the prize that they failed to glimpse a novel solution on the periphery. Rewards, we've seen, can limit the breadth of our thinking. But extrinsic motivators, especially tangible if-then ones, can also reduce the depth of our thinking. They can focus our sights only on what's immediately before us rather than what's off in the distance. Many times, a concentrated focus makes sense. If your office building is on fire, you want to find an exit immediately rather than ponder how to rewrite the zoning regulations. But in less dramatic circumstances, fixating on an immediate reward can damage performance over time. Indeed, what our earlier examples, unethical actions and addictive behavior, have in common, perhaps more than anything else, is that they're entirely short-term. Addicts want the quick fix regardless of the eventual harm. Cheaters want the quick win regardless of the lasting consequences. Yet even when the behavior doesn't devolve into shortcuts or addiction, the near-term allure of rewards can be harmful in the long run. Consider publicly held companies. Many such companies have existed for decades and hope to exist for decades more. But much of what their executives and middle managers do each day is aimed single-mindedly at the corporation's performance over the next 3 months. At these companies, quarterly earnings are an obsession. Executives devote substantial resources to making sure the earnings come out just right. And they spend considerable time and brain power offering guidance to stock analysts so that the market knows what to expect and therefore responds favorably. This laser focus on a narrow, near-term slice of corporate performance is understandable. It's a rational response to stock markets that reward or punish tiny blips in those numbers, which in turn affect executives' compensation. But companies pay a steep price for not extending their gaze beyond the next quarter. Several researchers have found that companies that spend the most time offering guidance on quarterly earnings deliver significantly lower long-term growth rates than companies that offer guidance less frequently. One reason? The earnings-obsessed companies typically invest less in research and development. They successfully achieve their short-term goals, but threaten the health of the company 2 or 3 years hence. As the scholars who warned about goals gone wild put it, the very presence of goals may lead employees to focus myopically on short-term gains and to lose sight of the potential devastating long-term effects on the organization. Perhaps nowhere is this clearer than in the economic calamity that gripped the world economy in 2008 and 2009. Each player in the system focused only on the short-term reward. The buyer who wanted a house, the mortgage broker who wanted a commission, the Wall Street trader who wanted new securities to sell, the politician who wanted a buoyant economy during re-election, and ignored the long-term effects of their actions on themselves or others. When the music stopped, the entire system nearly collapsed. This is the nature of economic bubbles. What seems to be irrational exuberance is ultimately a bad case of extrinsically motivated myopia. By contrast, the elements of genuine motivation that we'll explore later, by their very nature, defy a short-term view. Take mastery. The objective itself is inherently long-term because complete mastery, in a sense, is unattainable. Even Roger Federer, for instance, will never fully master the game of tennis. But introducing an if-then reward to help develop mastery usually backfires. That's why school children who are paid to solve problems typically choose easier problems and therefore learn less. The short-term prize crowds out the long-term learning. In environments where extrinsic rewards are most salient, many people work only to the point that triggers the reward and no further. So if students get a prize for reading 3 books, many won't pick up a 4th, let alone embark on a lifetime of reading. Just as executives who hit their quarterly numbers often won't boost earnings a penny more, let alone contemplate the long-term health of their companies. Likewise, several studies show that paying people to exercise, stop smoking, or take their medicines produces terrific results at first. But the healthy behavior disappears once the incentives are removed. However, when contingent rewards aren't involved, or when the incentives are used with the proper deftness, performance improves and understanding deepens. Greatness and nearsightedness are incompatible. Meaningful achievement depends on lifting one's sights and pushing toward the horizon. Let me summarize the 7 deadly flaws of carrots and sticks. 1. They can extinguish intrinsic motivation. 2. They can diminish performance. 3. They can crush creativity. 4. They can crowd out good behavior. 5. They can encourage cheating, shortcuts, and unethical behavior. 6. They can become addictive. 7. They can foster short-term thinking. Chapter 2A. And the special circumstances when they do. Carrots and sticks aren't all bad. If they were, Motivation 2.0 would never have flourished so long or accomplished so much. While an operating system centered around rewards and punishments has outlived its usefulness and badly needs an upgrade, that doesn't mean we should scrap its every piece. Indeed, doing so would run counter to the science. The scholars exploring human motivation have revealed not only the many glitches in the traditional approach, but also the narrow band of circumstances in which carrots and sticks do their jobs reasonably well. The starting point, of course, is to ensure that the baseline rewards, wages, salaries, benefits, and so on, are adequate and fair. Without a healthy baseline, motivation of any sort is difficult and often impossible. But once that's established, there are circumstances where it's okay to fall back on extrinsic motivators. To understand what those circumstances are, let's return to the candle problem. In his study, Sam Glucksberg found that the participants who were offered a cash prize took longer to solve the problem than those working in a reward-free environment. The reason, you'll recall, is that the prospect of a prize narrowed participants' focus and limited their ability to see an inventive, non-obvious solution. In the same experiment, Glucksberg presented a separate set of participants with a slightly different version of the problem. Once again, he told half of them he was timing their performance to collect data, and the other half that those who posted the fastest times could win cash. But he altered things just a bit. Instead of giving participants a box full of tacks, he emptied the tacks onto the desk. Can you guess what happened? This time, the participants vying for the reward solved the problem faster than their counterparts. Why? By removing the tacks and displaying the empty box, Glucksberg essentially revealed the solution. He transformed a challenging right-brain task into a routine left-brain one. Since participants simply had to race down an obvious path, the carrot waiting for them at the finish line encouraged them to gallop faster. Glucksberg's experiment provides the first question you should ask when contemplating external motivators. Is the task at hand routine? That is, does accomplishing it require following a prescribed set of rules to a specified end? For routine tasks, which aren't very interesting and don't demand much creative thinking, rewards can provide a small motivational booster shot without the harmful side effects. In some ways, that's just common sense. As Edward Deci, Richard Ryan, and Richard Kestner explain, rewards do not undermine people's intrinsic motivation for dull tasks because there is little or no intrinsic motivation to be undermined. Likewise, when Dan Ariely and his colleagues conducted their Madurai, India performance study with a group of MIT students, they found that when the task called for even rudimentary cognitive skill, a larger reward led to poorer performance. But as long as the task involved only mechanical skill, bonuses worked as they would be expected. The higher the pay, the better the performance. This is extremely important. Although advanced economies now revolve less around those algorithmic rule-based functions, some of what we do each day, especially on the job, still isn't all that interesting. We have TPS reports to fill out, and boring email to answer, and all manner of drudge work that doesn't necessarily fire our soul. What's more, for some people, much of what they do all day consists of these routine, not terribly captivating tasks. In these situations, it's best to try to unleash the positive side of the Sawyer effect by attempting to turn work into play, to increase the task's variety, to make it more like a game, or to use it to help master other skills. Alas, that's not always possible, and this means that sometimes, even if-then rewards are an option. Let's put this insight about rewards and routines into practice. Suppose you're a manager at a small nonprofit organization. Your design team created a terrific poster promoting your group's next big event, and now you need to send the poster to 20,000 members of your organization. Since the costs of outsourcing the job to a professional mailing firm are too steep for your budget, you decide to do the work in-house. Trouble is, the posters came back from the printer much later than you expected, and they need to get in the mail this weekend. What's the best way to enlist your staff of 10 and maybe a few others in a massive weekend poster mailing session? The task is the very definition of routine. The people participating must roll up the posters, slide them into the mailing tubes, cap those tubes, and apply a mailing label and the proper postage. Four steps, none of them notably interesting. One managerial option is coercion. If you're the boss, you could force people to spend their Saturday and Sunday on this mind-numbing project. They might comply, but the damage to their morale and long-term commitment could be substantial. Another option is to ask for volunteers. But face it, most people can think of far better ways to spend a weekend. So in this case, an if-then reward might be effective. For instance, you could promise a big office-wide party if everybody pitches in on the project. You could offer a gift certificate to everyone who participates. Or you could go further and pay people a small sum for every poster they insert, enclose, and send, in the hope that the piecework fee will boost their productivity. While such tangible contingent rewards can often undermine intrinsic motivation and creativity, those drawbacks matter less here. The assignment neither inspires deep passion nor requires deep thinking. Carrots in this case won't hurt and might help. And you'll increase your chances of success by supplementing the poster packing rewards with three important practices. First, offer a rationale for why the task is necessary. A job that's not inherently interesting can become more meaningful and therefore more engaging if it's part of a larger purpose. Explain why this poster is so important and why sending it out now is critical to your organization's mission. Second, acknowledge that the task is boring. This is an act of empathy, of course, and the acknowledgement will help people understand why this is the rare instance when if-then rewards are part of how your organization operates. Third, allow people to complete the task their own way. Think autonomy, not control. State the outcome you need, but instead of specifying precisely the way to reach it, how each poster must be rolled and how each mailing label must be affixed, give them freedom over how they do the job. That's the approach for routine tasks. What about for other sorts of undertakings? For work that requires more than just climbing rung by rung up a ladder of instructions, rewards are more perilous. The best way to avoid the seven deadly flaws of extrinsic motivators is to avoid them altogether or to downplay them significantly and instead emphasize the elements of deeper motivation, autonomy, mastery, and purpose that we'll explore later in the book. But in the workplace, a rigid adherence to this approach bumps up against a fact of life. Even people who do groovy, creative, right-brain work still want to be paid. And here, Teresa Amabile has shed some light on how to use rewards in a way that reckons with life's realities, but reduces extrinsic motivators' hidden costs. Go back to the study in which Amabile and two colleagues compared the quality of commissioned and non-commissioned paintings from a group of artists. A panel of experts, blind to what the investigators were exploring, consistently rated the non-commissioned artwork as more creative. One reason is that several artists said their commissions were constraining, that they found themselves working toward a goal they didn't endorse in a manner they didn't control. However, in the same study, Amabile also discovered that when the artists considered their commissions enabling, that is, the commission enabled the artist to do something interesting or exciting, the creativity ranking of what they produced shot back up. The same was true for commissions the artists felt provided them with useful information and feedback about their ability. This is a crucial research insight. The science shows that it is possible, though tricky, to incorporate rewards into non-routine, more creative settings without causing a cascade of damage. So, suppose we're back at your nonprofit 9 months later. The mailing went out flawlessly. The poster was a hit. The event was a smash. You're planning another for later this year. You've settled on the date and found your venue. Now you need an inspiring poster to captivate imaginations and draw a crowd. What should you do? Here's what you shouldn't do. Offer an if-then reward to the design staff. Do not stride into their offices and announce, "If you come up with a poster that rocks my world or that boosts attendance over last year, then you'll get a 10% bonus." Although that motivational approach is common in organizations all over the world, it's a recipe for reduced performance. Creating a poster isn't routine. It requires conceptual, breakthrough, artistic thinking. And as we've learned, if-then rewards are an ideal way to squash this sort of thinking. Your best approach is to have already established the conditions of a genuinely motivating environment. The baseline rewards must be sufficient, that is, the team's basic compensation must be adequate and fair, particularly compared with people doing similar work for similar organizations. Your nonprofit must be a congenial place to work. And the people on your team must have autonomy, they must have ample opportunity to pursue mastery, and their daily duties must relate to a larger purpose. If these elements are in place, the best strategy is to provide a sense of urgency and significance and then get out of the talent's way. But you may still be able to boost performance a bit, more for future tasks than for this one, through the delicate use of rewards. Just be careful. Your efforts will backfire unless the rewards you offer meet one essential requirement, and you'll be on firmer motivational footing if you follow two additional principles. The essential requirement. Any extrinsic reward should be unexpected and offered only after the task is complete. Holding out a prize at the beginning of a project and offering it as a contingency will inevitably focus people's attention on obtaining the reward rather than on attacking the problem. But introducing the subject of rewards after the job is done is less risky. In other words, where if-then rewards are a mistake, shift to now that rewards, as in, now that you finished the poster and it turned out so well, I'd like to celebrate by taking you out to lunch. As DC and his colleagues explain, if tangible rewards are given unexpectedly to people after they have finished a task, the rewards are less likely to be experienced as the reason for doing the task and are thus less likely to be detrimental to intrinsic motivation. Likewise, Amabile has found in some studies that the highest levels of creativity were produced by subjects who received a reward as a kind of a bonus. So when the poster turns out great, you could buy the design team a case of beer or even hand them a cash bonus without snuffing their creativity. The team didn't expect any extras, and getting them didn't hinge on a particular outcome. You're simply offering your appreciation for their stellar work. But keep in mind one ginormous caveat. Repeated now that bonuses can quickly become expected if-then entitlements, which can ultimately crater effective performance. At this point, by limiting rewards for non-routine creative work to the unexpected now that variety, you're in less dangerous waters. But you'll do even better if you follow two more guidelines. First, consider non-tangible rewards. Praise and positive feedback are much less corrosive than cash and trophies. In fact, in DC's original experiments and in his subsequent analysis of other studies, he found that positive feedback can have an enhancing effect on intrinsic motivation. So if the folks on the design team turn out a show-stopping poster, maybe just walk into their offices and say, "Wow, you did a really amazing job on that poster. It's going to have a huge impact on getting people to come to this event. Thank you." It sounds small and simple, but it can have an enormous effect. Second, provide useful information. Amabile has found that while controlling extrinsic motivators can clobber creativity, informational or enabling motivators can be conducive to it. In the workplace, people are thirsting to learn about how they're doing, but only if the information isn't a tacit effort to manipulate their behavior. So don't tell the design team, "That poster was perfect. You did it exactly the way I asked." Instead, give people meaningful information about their work. The more feedback focuses on specifics, great use of color, and the more the praise is about effort and strategy rather than about achieving a particular outcome, the more effective it can be. In brief, for creative, right-brain heuristic tasks, you're on shaky ground offering if-then rewards. You're better off using now-that rewards, and you're best off if your now-that rewards provide praise, feedback, and useful information.